So welcome to the fall retreat here at Mount Baldy Zen Center. As you all know, the topic for the retreat is there is no enemy. Now, I'll be quite up front with you. Exactly what we'll be doing, I have some ideas, but how this is going to unfold, we will see as it unfolds, because this will be the first time I've actually approached this topic in a retreat. And as Carrie said earlier, in a certain sense, you're all guinea pigs, but basically everybody who ever comes to retreat with me is a guinea pig, because I very rarely do the same thing twice. So it's always a bit of an experiment. This phrase, there is no enemy, came up very much from my own experience a bit over a year ago. I had experienced a very significant shift in my practice, which was very deep and very disconcerting, because I'd finished a 10-day retreat in New Mexico with a group of 18 people teaching the Mahamudra. There was a 3-day break between retreats where I was hanging out with a couple of people who were there for both retreats. And then I was to do another 10-day retreat with a different group of people on Dzogchen. And in the middle of this break, everything just shifted in me, and I no longer had any idea what I was going to teach in the second retreat. So it was very irritating, or not exactly irritating, just like, okay, now what? And the shift had a lot to do with really experiencing that there was just nothing to push against. And sometime during that time, this phrase just came to mind, there is no enemy. And I looked it up on Google, and there was nothing. It is actually not a common phrase at all, though it is now the name of an album put out by a rock band in Des Moines, Iowa. So if you look it up on Google, that's what you're going to get. And so Google's filled with that stuff. But the album is very honest. The group is very honest. They say this is an album name. It is not a philosophy. So I'm going to say this is a philosophy, not an album name. Okay, so for most of us, there's very definitely a posture of opposition, deeply, deeply conditioned. I was reading something on more of this brain imaging stuff, and running some experiments on brain imaging with people watching sports, and how if they're watching a sports event between two teams that from two different cities that they didn't belong to, they just watched it and there was no particular brain activity in a certain region. But when one of the teams was was from their city, then a whole another area of the brain lit up. Now, it's very uncertain what the lighting up of the brain actually means in this these PET scans. There's a lot of speculation, but it does possibly suggest that this tribal identification, us versus them, is very, very deeply conditioned to us, both biologically, through evolution, psychologically, emotionally, etc., etc., etc. And yet, and it's functional in a certain way, in that it creates group cohesion, which enhances survival, etc., etc. But it also is the source of a great deal of suffering for ourselves and others, as all of us know. So, as we, what we're doing in spiritual practice, generally speaking, is trying to find a way to come to terms with this experience we call life. And all of you are here because you think that by attending this retreat, it's going to help you in some way, either learn some skills or build some capacities or gain some insights or something like that, which will help you negotiate this experience in a better way. And I'm going to leave better here very, very undefined. Now, we run into all kinds of things in the context of spiritual practice, many of which I've come to question quite deeply. One which I let go of a long time ago was the idea that all spiritual practices lead to the same thing. There's one enlightenment, and, you know, everybody it's the same for everybody who experiences it. Well, maybe, but I don't think so. A few years ago, I received an email inviting me to participate in a film project called that was going to discuss the common vision of non-duality that was present in all spiritual traditions. And I'm not that well known in North America, so I was very surprised to get this invitation. So I emailed back, said, I'm very happy to feel quite honored by this. However, in spirit of full disclosure, what you're taking as a fact, I regard as a question. 15 minutes later, my phone rang. What? was basically what the other person saying. We had a rather difficult conversation, which basically ended when I said, look, let's get down to basics. If you and I take a slice of pie from the same strawberry pie and each of us eat it, we actually have no idea whether we have the same experience or not. And if that's the case for strawberry pie, I can't see there's going to be any different for non-dualistic vision or whatever. And there was sort of a grunt at the other end, and we concluded the phone call, and an hour later I got an email saying that, you're right, you're probably not the right person for this movie. How to Win Friends and Influence People. Do not study with me. So, I think it's very important to keep that general aim in mind. In Buddhism, this is generally described, the aim is described as ending suffering. And people have many, many ideas about what that means. And a lot of people think, well, you reach a state where you simply don't suffer anymore. It's a case of achieving a state. That may happen for some people. I've heard people describe that for them. I'm not sure that it happens for everybody. I'm not sure that it can happen for everybody. And my own feeling is that when we talk about ending suffering, it's about learning how to live life a different way so that the ending of suffering takes place moment to moment. And to give you a very simple example of that, how many of you have had the experience of getting carried away by thought and getting into quite a negative state because of that? Okay. So there, ending suffering means being able to just experience that negative thought and not get all wrapped up in it, allowing it to propagate, etc. Now, I'm feeling somewhat sheepish teaching this retreat because I had a two-week experience of getting completely wrapped up with certain thoughts about AT&T. And I spent 2 weeks absolutely in full rage. And I'm not, you know, angry enough that people were hanging up on me at the other end of the phone. And because, I mean, they managed to do everything that irritated me. Eventually, their corporate process ground through, so everything got fixed and it's all working now. And so now I feel rather sheepish about the whole thing. But we create an awful lot of suffering, not just for ourselves, but for other people, by not being able to experience certain things. So one of the central theses of this retreat, and something that I've certainly found through my own experience, is that we experience the notion of enemy, of something opposing us, arises because of because in the interaction with whatever that is, a feeling comes up in us which we are unable to experience for whatever reason. And me being without the internet was an intolerable experience for me. Because I do a lot of work through email and things like that. So I just felt like, and if I'd been smart, I would have said, oh, I'm out without internet for a few days. Cool. But since I'd been away for a month and I needed to catch up with like 300 emails, I wasn't too cool about that. There's that in that experience in ourselves that we can't experience, and whatever is bringing up that experience, we label as enemy. And now we try to get that out of our experience completely. So one of the things, as a kind of framework this evening, I want to offer a kind of systems perspective on this. I'm going to give you three definitions here. A definition of relationship, a definition of conflict, and a definition of enemy, which we'll be using in this context of this retreat. The definition of relationship is this. A relationship is the experience of interaction between two worlds, one's own world of experience and another world, another's world of experience. It's the experience of that interaction. That's what a relationship is. Now, there's a whole bunch of stuff that I could say about relationships, which I probably am not going to hear. I'm doing a program in February in the Bay Area on specifically on relationship and conflict. So, in the middle of February, there I'll go into it a lot in great detail. But for our purposes, the relationship is the experience of interaction between two worlds. Conflict can only arise in the context of relationship. If there's no interaction, you can't have any conflict. That's something people forget about conflict. They say, I don't have a relationship with that person. I'm fighting with them all the time. Oh, yes, you do. You have a very intimate relationship with that person. Conflict is the experience of resistance to change when two or more worlds interact. And it's very simple. You know, we have person A here and person B here. Person A has their world of experience, person B has their world of experience. When they interact, they're in a relationship. But the moment they start to interact, a third world is created. We'll call that world C. Now, the question is, what is C going to look like? Person A assumes that C is going to look like A. Person B assumes that C is going to look like B. You have conflict. Now, if both of them can say, oh, C is going to be like C, and they can both move into it, then you have a relationship, no conflict. But that doesn't usually happen, because either A wants to hold on to certain things that actually aren't going to operate in C, or B wants certain things to operate in C, which may or may not happen. And so one or other, or both, resist the change, and that's what generates the conflict. It's a systems view of it. Yes, microphone, please. Oh, just turn it on at the bottom and leave it on. It's better that way. Then it doesn't crash.
Does it have to be between two people? What about conflict within yourself?
Oh, yes, because there you have one part of you and another part of you, two worlds. So I'm just gave the example of two people, but they could be two corporations, two nations, two a person and a group. One part of yourself, another part of yourself. I mean, absolutely. That's why I say it's a systems view. You have one world here, another world here. They start to interact. That defines a relationship. But in the interaction, they create a third world. And how do they both change that? Part of one resists moving into that third world. So conflict is generated. Okay? An enemy is anything we have to remove from our world of experience. Anything we have to remove from our world of experience.
Can you define remove?
Well, it's in our world of experience. We want it out of there. Okay? Now, very simple example. You're building something and you hit your thumb with a hammer. What do you want to do with your thumb at that point? Get it out of your world of experience. Yeah. Not really possible, but, you know, like, oh, fine, now I feel better because it's hurting. You know, or you burn your hand on a stove. So very often there are feelings, sensations, physical sensations, etc., that we just want to get rid of. How many of you have been engaged in a project and there's one person you just want to get off the project? You know, get them out of your life. See, this is what defines an enemy. So it is anything which we want to get out of our, or have to get out of our world of experience. And so there's a kind of pressure or urgency there. That's how it feels. That's what makes it an enemy. I can't tolerate this. So we're going to be looking at the relationship we have with our experience. That's going to be a very important part of this retreat. Because, and I can speak from very, very long personal experience here with my own body. For various reasons, it has been a source of consistent and sometimes very, very considerable pain and discomfort for me. And I can tell you, for very long periods of time, I just wanted that pain to go away. Didn't want to have anything to do with it. And set up this very, very strong opposition, which was completely ineffective. It didn't allow anything to resolve. And I had to work quite deeply in changing my relationship with that. Because when we want to get something out of our experience, we're actually creating an imbalance in our experience. And that imbalance creates problems for ourselves and problems for everybody that we interact with. And that is how suffering comes about. It is primarily through trying to avoid or control or manage what actually is arising in our experience. Now, how are we going to do this? Well, over the next 3 days, we're going to work. Each day, we're going to focus on one part of a process. The first day, it's going to be about bringing attention to what arises. The second day will be about taking that a step further, letting that attention penetrate and into what arises, so experience it more deeply, and learning how to hold attention in the reactive processes that arise. And in the third day, we'll continue that work of holding attention in the reactive processes, which is where the sense of enemy often arises, is right there. And then start to explore what happens, how to receive what is there when the reactive process falls apart, because the reactive process does fall apart. Not every case, but in many cases. And when it falls apart, we discover very, very different possibilities of being able to relate to our experience. So that's the general framework we're going to be using day one, day two, and day three. The demarcations aren't absolute because there are basically four components over 3 days, so we'll just work that out as we go forward. For tomorrow morning, for your meditation practice, I just want you to practice resting in attention. So probably for most of you, that's going to mean just resting in the experience of breathing. So just very simple meditation, not trying to do anything fancy because we're still coming and getting settled in the retreat. So tomorrow morning when you get up, we'll be in the Zendo together. Just rest in the experience of breathing. Keep coming back to that. And all of you, I think, have seen the way that I like to explain meditation. This is the experience of breathing. This is attention. You rest attention in the experience of breathing. It falls off, something happens. There's always a moment of recognition. Come back, rest in the experience of breathing, falls off again. So you're going to return, rest, recognize, return, rest, recognize, return, rest. And that's meditation. Now, there are two points here which I think never hurts to remember. First is, I'm talking about resting in the experience of breathing rather than focusing on or concentrating on something, because I find that actually increases the sense of opposition. I'm focusing on this. When you rest in the experience of breathing, you actually can just be in that experience, and so there's less separation. And the second thing is that rather than try to hold attention there, you rest. Something comes along, distracts us, it happens all the time. You recognize and return. So returning and resting, rather than try to hold attention, I found more productive for most people in terms of actually building a capacity of attention, because that capacity comes through the resting quality. So return and rest, return and rest. And don't be at all disturbed about the number of times you have to return. If, for instance, in a half-hour meditation, you return 100 times, it means you are distracted for a very, very short period of time. You got to look on the bright side of things. Now, a couple of quotations, which I'll end with. First one is a quotation from my commentary on the Heart Sutra. Which I tried to describe how easily anything becomes a source of division in our lives. Hello, I've got the wrong page. That's annoying. Oh no, Yeah, that is the wrong page. Now I've got to find it. Oh, there it is. No, that's not it. Trouble is, I don't know where anything is in this book. Okay. Fortunately, it's not too long a book, so I should be able to find it in theory. Pardon? Yeah, I know, it always disappears, doesn't it? Ah, here we are. First, it was an opening, then a memory, then an idea. Unnoticed, it became a belief, and then an ideology. Now it's a casus belli, and you are ready to wreak havoc on all who disagree. And anybody recognize that? So it's very easy to create enemies. Almost anything works. And that's something to be on guard against. And how do we deal with this? Well, this is a collection of poems, very loosely termed poems, written by Thomas Merton from when he was reading Chuang Tzu, right? He was working from an old translation because it was the only one that was around when he was doing this, and just read these passages and then recast them into these rather loose English poems because that's how they spoke to him. This one's called Cutting Up an Ox. And basically is the theme we'll be working with tomorrow. Prince Wen Hui's cook was cutting up an ox. Out went a hand, down went a shoulder. He planted a foot, he pressed with a knee. The ox fell apart with a whisper. The bright cleaver murmured like a gentle wind. Rhythm, timing like a sacred dance, like the mulberry grove, like ancient harmonies. "Good work," the prince exclaimed. "Your method is faultless." "Method?" said the cook, laying aside his cleaver. "What I follow is Tao, beyond all methods. When I first began to cut up oxen, I would see before me the whole ox, all in one mass. After 3 years, I no longer saw this mass. I saw the distinctions. But now, I see nothing with the eye. My whole being apprehends. My senses are idle. The spirit, free to work without plan, follows its own instinct, guided by natural line, by the secret opening, the hidden space. My cleaver finds its way. I cut through no joint, chop no bone. A good cook needs a new chopper once a year. He cuts. A poor cook needs a new one every month. He hacks. I have used this same cleaver 19 years. It has cut up 1,000 oxen. Its edge is as keen as if newly sharpened. There are spaces in the joints. The blade is thin and keen. when this thinness finds that space, there is all the room you need. It goes like a breeze. Hence, I have this cleaver 19 years as if newly sharpened. True, there are sometimes tough joints. I feel them coming. I slow down. I watch closely. Hold back. Barely move the blade. And whomp. The whole part falls away, landing like a clod of earth. Then I withdraw the blade. I stand still and let the joy of the work sink in. I clean the blade and put it away. Prince Wan Hui said, "This is it. My cook has shown me how I ought to live my own life."
All rights in this podcast given by Ken MacLeod are reserved and owned by Unfettered Mind. This podcast and all elements within it are protected by the copyright laws of the United States and international copyright treaties. Unfettered Mind podcasts and clips of these podcasts are possible only because of the support of listeners such as you. To make a donation, please go to unfetteredmind.org.